This is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. I'm Sam Evans Brown. If I asked you to name one type of job that isn't currently affected in some way by the COVID-19 pandemic, could you do it? Just about everyone is either stuck at home, working while exposed, laid off, or generally disrupted. And across the board, scientists who work in or study the natural world are in the same boat. And buried in the data they're collecting are new and profoundly strange examples of how we shape the world, or at least what we know about it. Later in the show, we'll be taking breaks from coronavirus news to learn about eating invasive green crabs and the difference between turtles and tortoise, plus some very important turtle facts. But we'll also be sharing a few interviews with scientists who have found their work, in some way or another, interrupted, influenced, or in some way altered by COVID-19. And we're starting with one of my favorite subjects, weather.
Video into the Weather Channel, the Chattanooga Metro under a tornado emergency overnight, taking down power.
Thankfully,
lines.
A lot of technology that meteorologists rely on is automated. That means that some stay-at-home orders didn't prevent scientists from warning us about some of the terrible storms that swept through the East Coast this week.
Looks like those strong winds in southern Maine come in this afternoon, during the middle of the afternoon, maybe peaking around.
But that doesn't mean that weather forecasting is immune to COVID-19.
Oops. Something's playing on my computer. Sorry.
That's
okay. I have our website up.
Ryan Brenton is a broadcast meteorologist with News Center Maine. I invited him on to explain why. Hey, Ryan.
Hey, Sam. Thanks so much for having me.
So tell me about the data that weather models use to predict the weather. Where's that data coming from, and how is the pandemic having any bearing on our forecasting?
Well, it's actually kind of interesting because there's been so much discussion about modeling in general lately, modeling how the virus will spread, when the curve may flatten. So people are hearing a lot about models just in everyday conversation on the news, even more so than usual. And one phrase that has really caught my eye, because it applies very much to weather forecasting, is that a model is only as good as the data going into it. So weather models really rely on modeling the atmosphere in its current state as close to perfect as they can. Because if the current weather isn't modeled correctly, then those errors can multiply days and days out. So it really starts with understanding things like the temperature, the humidity, the cloud cover, the amount of moisture in the air at all levels of the atmosphere all over the globe. And then you can start the model to predict out the future.
And what are the sources for that data? I mean, where do we get those real-world observations?
So, unfortunately, we don't have a thermometer on every single point of the planet. If we did, that'd be really easy. But there are three main sources of that data. The first is satellites. They are able to estimate different weather variables at various levels of the atmosphere. Another one that many people know of are weather balloons, but the second most important way that we sample the atmosphere is actually through airplanes, even just commercial airplanes. You know, you may be going on a trip to Florida, flying out of Manchester, and on your entire trip, that airplane is actually sending data back that is fed into our weather computers. It samples the temperature, the pressure, the humidity on your flight up into the atmosphere. And that data is really important because what's going on above us is almost more important to our models than what's going on right here at the ground level. And you really only can get that actual data through weather balloons or through airplanes.
So, of course, airplanes seem like the main source of disruption with the ongoing pandemic. There's a ton of air traffic that's been grounded.
Absolutely. This has been most notable over Europe, particularly the last month. A lot of people not into meteorology may have heard of the European model. It's one of the most reliable weather models used worldwide, and it's actually privately run by a bunch of European countries, and you have to pay to access the data. So it's a little bit better than some of the models we have here, which are taxpayer funded, and there are different programs that rely on funding. So it's one of the better models that meteorologists rely on. But they found that the amount of data over Europe dropped 80% obtained by aircraft through the month of March. And I reached out to them and asked, what is the impact over North America or through the United States? And they found that there's been a drop of 63% in the amount of data that's going into the models through aircraft. So this is having a real tangible effect on the amount of information we're starting our models with, just because there's been such a sharp reduction in air travel worldwide.
And have you noticed that in your own forecast? Have you seen ways in which, garbage is going in and you're getting garbage out?
Exactly. I'd say that at the moment, I haven't noticed anything too significant. But where it would be noticed is at the jet stream level. And the jet stream is what steers our storms. So if this goes on for a longer period of time, it may become more noticeable. It also means that there could be bigger swings between different computer models. But what you really like to see is all the models showing a similar idea. But if the amount of data going into them is different and the levels of that data going in is different, then their projections many days out are likely to become even more varied. So if this is something that continues for the next few months, particularly once we get into hurricane season, I feel like it'll be a much more noticeable effect, particularly on longer range forecasts, 5 to 10 days.
Cool. Ryan, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you, Sam. Really appreciate you reaching out, and hope you and your family and everybody gets through this all right.
Not every scientist has the luxury of working with a subject that they like.
Brat.
Gabby Brand is a scientist with the University of New Hampshire, and that was the sound of her detaching a green crab that had vice-pincered itself onto the flesh between her thumb and pointer finger.
See, they're mean.
Yeah, defensive stance.
And
very intimidating.
Yeah, and the females are actually meaner, I feel.
Up here in the Northeast, green crabs are absolutely everywhere. They look just like your standard beachy, tide pool-y crab, but they're green. They're from Europe, but have been on the east coast of the United States for 200 years. They've invaded Australia, South Africa, the west coast of the US, and South America. In other words, they're now on 5 of the 7 continents.
They find a nice niche, they outcompete everything else, they ruin everything they see, they're mean, and they take over. Up in Maine, they completely decimated the softshell clam population up there and caused like millions and millions and millions of dollars worth of loss in income.
Yeah, they just sound like they're the worst.
They are. They're the worst ever.
However, as you and I and anybody who likes seafood is aware, crabs are delicious.
No other species can defeat them.
They're invasive.
So why don't we just freaking eat them?
Because we're hungry.
Eat the invaders.
This is Outside In, and today is our occasional segment about eating invasive pest species. Gabby's quest to eat green crabs began several years ago when a friend of hers from Louisiana pointed out, hey, y'all have a crab problem? Why not eat them into submission? Have you ever tried a softshell crab?
So that started me on that project of, let's try and figure this out.
Softshells, by the way, are in fact just regular crabs, but crabs have an exoskeleton which they have to shed as they grow. It's called molting, and for a few days after they molt, their whole body is soft and you can eat the whole dang thing. So here's a quick explanation of why we eat the crabs that we do at the local Jack Black Crab and Tackle Shack.
Can you just introduce yourself?
Yeah.
I'm Brendan Vesey at Joinery Restaurant in Newmarket.
As a fisher, you don't go out trying to catch crabs that have just molted in the day or so before their shells harden back up again. You catch them when they're not soft and then watch for signs that they're about to molt.
But a soft crab, this would be a perfect little starter.
When it's a blue crab, the American crab that most of our soft shells are, as the crab grows, the plates in its shell start to spread apart and show a dark outline around the edge of each one. It's really obvious, and fishers call them busters, as in they're about to bust out of their shell.
So let me just lay them right in the skillet.
Once you find a buster, you separate it out into its own cage, jokingly called a crab condo, so that when it molts, the other crabs don't tear it to pieces. And then you check it every day, because as soon as it molts, you've got to get that sucker to a restaurant or a market while it's still soft.
Yeah, we're just going to get some of the extra grease off.
This taste test at the Joinery was actually about a year ago with former producer Logan Shannon.
It's really good. It's weird because it's like I'm putting a crab in my mouth, but then the time it gets in your mouth is so soft that it sort of like just dissolves. It's seafoody.
I think they have an intensely crabby flavor, which is why we like making the stock for the soup, because I think it tastes stronger than other crab flavor.
I would eat a lot of these.
They are delicious, and people will pay top dollar for them. But the whole process of getting a soft-shell crab is premised on being able to identify the crabs that are about to molt. And Gabby Brandt realized that nobody had any idea what to look for in these green crabs. So she caught a bunch of them and sent them to her friend's lab down in Louisiana to be monitored. They were looking for morphological changes, physical changes that one was about to molt.
And my colleague down there had it in her tank for, I don't know, 4 or 5 months, and she got one to molt.
So there goes year one. Year two, they decided to keep the crabs in their own tanks and take constant pictures of them every day so that they could study the molting process. They started by trying to trap 50 males and 50 females. This plan immediately met headwinds because they couldn't find any male crabs.
Because it was the wrong season. We only found females. So we're like, well, that's weird. And then we took many, many, many pictures and we got one molt again.
Turns out the females really only molt in the late summer. So, another year gone. Year three, trapped a bunch of females, this time in the right time of year.
And we got 80% of all of our females to molt because we were in the correct time, correct temperature, awesome, took pictures. We have a timeline when we caught them to the day they molted. And we went back and looked for morphological characteristics and oh, nothing.
I've joked that this Eat the Invaders segment rarely offers good solutions to the problems of invasive species. But green crabs are very easy to catch. They come up in traps by the hundreds sometimes. So I can imagine a world where there are enough overlapping markets, crab as bait, crab eggs, crab mulch, crab compost, to support enough of a green crab fishery to knock the population back. But to really get fishers interested, to really get them hauling up crabs in huge quantities off the seafloor where they're causing so much trouble, it would be nice to have a high-end market. Something like softshell crabs, which can sell for $20, $30, $40 a pound. Compare that to lobster, which floats between $6 and $12 a pound. But Gabby had tried to use the scientific method to come up with clues about the molting process, and no dice. So what to do? To figure it out, the scientists leave the scientific method behind after a quick break. Hey folks, this is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. I'm Sam Evans Brown. Remember, American scientists are trying to figure out how to spot when green crabs are about to molt. And they aren't having any luck. That is, until
an acquaintance of mine came to me, and so that's sort of what sparked it all.
This is Marissa McMahon, a scientist from Maine that works with a nonprofit called the Manomet Center.
I grew up here. My family are all fishermen from this area, and so I've really been immersed in fisheries, commercial fisheries, my whole life.
She was studying and working on fisheries science in college, but hadn't ever been much interested in the green crab problem, even though she saw the impacts of it
all the time.
They're a species that is incredibly well adapted to so many different environments. They can withstand high temperatures, low temperatures. They can actually, there's a study that just came out from some researchers on the West Coast that actually found that they can absorb nutrients through their gills, so they don't even have to eat. I mean, they can go extended periods of time without eating and be fine. It's just, it's wild. So, and they're aggressive and they're a voracious predator.
Marissa had this acquaintance, a guy who happened to be a fine arts conservator who spent a lot of time in Venice, like Venice, Italy.
And he was in Venice and he was eating deep fried soft shell green crabs. And so he came to me and said, why aren't we doing this here?
What's the Italian name for soft shell crabs?
It's molecche.
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 This.
Hi everyone, I'm Paolo.
Is Paolo Tagliapietra.
I'm from Venice and I'm a fisherman.
I talked to him on WhatsApp. It's a little bit boggling to think about this, but green crabs invaded America in 1817. So it was 199 years from that date before Western scientists first became aware of the fact that the invasive scourge of our estuaries is also a straight-up Venetian delicacy.
It's a fishery that represent the lagoon of Venice, you know.
Right, so it's like when you come to Venice, that's a thing you have to do.
The most specific, there's nothing more Venetian.
Marissa's friend got her in touch with Paolo, and she went to visit his family. She and another lobsterman from Maine spent about a week in Venice last year.
They had a guest house that was right next to their house.
It was like a fishing exchange student program.
Paolo's mother cooked for us every day. It was just astounding. I've never eaten so much food in my life.
Every day they would wake up early.
We'd start the day out. We'd go out with Paolo in his boat, just like an open skiff.
Out on the Venetian lagoon, hauling in nets.
We would probably do that for 3 or 4 hours, and we would end up with about 800 pounds of green crabs.
There is something about the sound of a giant crate full of crabs, big, glistening, pincery ocean bugs crawling all over each other, that I find really unsettling. Once they get them onto the dock, the sorting begins. Well, actually,
we'd actually break for lunch and we'd have like a 2.5 hour long lunch. And then we would
go. Italy.
Because, yes, yeah. And, you know, at lunch, of course, everyone's like drinking Prosecco. And that was different for me. I was like, oh, it's nap time. It's not time to go back to work.
Okay, now the sorting begins.
Can I just point out, it's kind of funny how you use the crab's leg to point.
Well, it's a natural pointer.
It almost feels like the crab's like betraying itself.
This is where science has not caught up to tradition. Gabby Brandt, the careful scientist from the start of the story, caught 50 crabs, took many high-definition photos of them, 80% molted, but she couldn't detect any sign that distinguished the ones that were about to molt from the others.
I don't think I'm any good at this.
And generally speaking, that's what happens to people who are new to sorting crabs, is what happened to Marissa over in Italy.
We would stand around the sorting table with them, and we would pick crabs out and show them to them, you know, and they would just shake their head no.
Even after Paolo and his father had explained what to look for, the incredibly slight dark rings around the belly scales of the crabs that are about to molt, the puffy rear end that signaled water was getting inside the crab's shell as the plates spread and split, the sluggish behavior as the crab gets weaker before it sheds its carapace.
And it was just again and again and again. No, no, no.
After a week of doing this, after seeing tens of thousands of pounds of crabs, after an internship with the masters of spotting crabs about to molt.
Then that it happened that she showed me the crabs and I said, yes, another one, yes. But after she gave me a completely wrong crab, so I realized that she hadn't understood.
Meanwhile, Marissa says that Paolo, who learned from his father, and Paolo's father, who learned from his grandfather,
they're doing it like supersonic speed compared to us. So they'll dump, you know, 100 pounds at a time on the sorting table, and they don't even need to look at the crabs. I mean, most of them, they're just pushing and discarding. And once in a while, they'll look at a crab from the back of it. They won't even turn it over, which is, I mean, we're looking at the underside of the crab to figure out the premolts. They'll just look at the top carapace side of the crab and pull it, and they'll know.
Wait, how do they know?
They're just that good. And I mean, that's what they told us, you know. It's the easiest to learn looking at the underside of the crab. Those are the easiest signs to learn. But if you get really good at that, you start seeing other signs. You start to see that there's other things about the crab that are changing. And so they're so good that they don't even need to really look at the crab. They just see it in the pile of other crabs, and it's different to them somehow, and they just pull it out and throw it aside.
It's like wizardry.
It is. It's crazy.
You might have thought that you were signing on for a story about delicious soft-shell crab po' boys, but the truth is that this is a story about the limits of science. And let me just say right here, I am a big fan of the scientific method. I love to read about experimental design, about what the results of a study can and can't tell us, about what areas need more study, but science has some big blind spots. For instance, the fact that scientists mostly hang out with other scientists and not, say, Mediterranean fishers.
Green crabs have been in North America. They invaded in 1817. They've been here for more than 200 years. And scientists have been studying them for, you know, well over 100 years. But no one ever knew about this premolt indicator until we started connecting with these Venetian fishermen.
Well, no American scientists knew.
It's hard to generalize, but it's almost like Western science is not quite ready. Like the fact that it took us from 1817 until 2018 to be like, oh, maybe we should ask these people who've been working with them for like hundreds of years.
Absolutely. And it's interesting too, because there was disagreement amongst Paolo and his father and his brother-in-law. So like, even amongst them, they're sometimes looking for different things. So I think, yeah, there's definitely a part of it that is it's sort of like a gut feeling almost, and like we can't rely on that in science, right? So I think that's part of the reason why, you know, there hasn't really been any major scientific breakthroughs on that front.
Centuries old, traditional ways of doing things are often results of generations of experimentation. How did the first Venetian crabbers figure out which green crabs were about to molt? I can only speculate, but I can tell you it wasn't through high-resolution cameras and computer analysis. They must have had to catch a lot of crabs, hold on to a lot of them, watch carefully every day, turning them over and over in their hands, fishing season after fishing season. Hundreds of fishers, without phones or television to distract them, spending years on the water observing hundreds of thousands of crabs. Then they showed their children, who showed their children. How could a couple people in a lab compete with centuries of data like that? One can take this idea too far. I'm not one who's going to argue that the old ways are always better, but I think it's pretty fair to say, and I think science has begun to recognize, that there are vast stores of discoveries that we could tap into if science started to take a closer look at traditions and ancient skills. Paolo has created an 11-page guide to crab molting, but even he says you really can't learn except by sorting crabs side by side with an expert. So for this to work in Maine, somehow this particular skill will have to make its way across the Atlantic. And if it does, it just might launch a new industry.
Can you give me your name? First James.
This is the lobster man who went to visit Venice with Marissa and Paolo.
You went to Venice?
Oh yeah.
How was that?
It was amazing. It was different. But it was a great trip. Learned a lot. And now I'm doing it here.
When we stood around the sorting table in Maine, Chris had a little bit of that Italian wizardry that Marissa described.
Let's see, it's like a...
like the ring around the scale.
The very end of it.
Yeah.
All the way up through, and they're starting to fade. He really doesn't have a lot of strength in his arm and his claws. He's slowing down.
This spring is the first time he's tried to sell the crabs. The day I met him, Chris said he had about 30 back at his place that he had successfully identified as premolt and that had, in fact, shed their shell once he separated them into their little crab condos.
A lot to it.
Yeah.
But those are just kind of some of the...
After, it's like you have to see like 600 crabs before you can start to tell?
A lot more than that. I mean, it's probably been like 20,000 pounds, it seems like, to really start to really focus in on what's good and what's not.
Chris took his soft shells to a high-end restaurant later that day, and he texted me after meeting with the chef. He told me the crabs sold for $30 a pound, and they told him to bring back more as soon as he had them. That was an installment of our occasional series, Eat the Invaders. It aired back in 2018. We have got pictures of green crabs on our website if you want to check them out. You can go to outsideinradio.org and click through our episodes to find this one. It's called Molto Moleque. You're listening to Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. I'm Sam Evans Brown. On today's broadcast, we're looking at different ways that the coronavirus pandemic is affecting scientists. And one of the fields that has made headlines is seismology. Producer Taylor Quimby spoke with Peggy Helweg of the Berkeley Seismology Laboratory in California. She explained to him that in order to study earthquakes, you've always got to keep your ears to the ground. And that can mean accidentally detecting sounds that you're not listening for.
We are interested in everywhere, and we have stations in many locations. We sometimes have human-caused noise. We have one station that's actually next to a 40-foot radio antenna, 100 yards away maybe. But when the radio antenna moves, then we see the grinding of the antenna's motors on our seismic sensors.
Hmm. So what have you been seeing in this time of the coronavirus when, so much of our activity has just lurched to a halt? Are you seeing that in your data?
We do see that in our data, particularly for the stations that are in areas where there are a lot of people. We have one, for example, in a building that's just down the hill from our regular building. It's called Haviland Hall. We continue to operate a station there, even though it's in a building in the middle of campus, because one of our first seismic stations more than 100 years ago was installed there. And we want to be able to continue to have data that we can compare with our old records.
Yeah.
So almost a month ago, the university closed, sent everybody home. And since then, the noise level during the day is much more like the noise level that we see on weekends when not much is going on. There are some stations that are really, really remote, and my guess is there's not very much change at those stations, but the stations that are close to people or close to roads are all going to experience a much lower level of movement, activity, sound, noise than they usually do.
So is this a good thing or a bad thing, or is it just data? I mean, does this change matter for the work that you do at all?
So from the point of view of small earthquakes, the size of the smallest earthquakes that we can measure nearby doesn't really change very much. But for distant earthquakes, so let's say there's a magnitude 1.5 earthquake, it's right underneath our station, then of course it doesn't make any difference. We would still be able to measure it. But if it's a 1.5 earthquake that's, say, 100 kilometers away from us, 60 miles away, under normal conditions, we might not be able to measure it. But now we can see it clearly in our record because of the lower level of noise. One of the exciting things that's happening is that we can look for things in the noise. We can discriminate between things that are repetitions of something, say this earthquake that was 60 miles away, and things that are random, like a truck driving by. And so we can use the data that we're collecting now in this time with low noise to see things and then go back and look at them in the data that we have that was noisier.
Right. It's almost like a way to learn how to filter out the bad stuff.
Yes. To do that, it's good to have an example that of what you're looking for.
Right, right. Well, okay, so that, I mean, that sounds like, you know, I mean, this is a big, horrible, tragic mess, but that sounds like a weird little good thing for seismology.
It's a weird little good thing for seismology.
The real stress test here is the human element, it sounds like.
Yeah, and under these conditions, the human element is a very important element in making sure we can keep things running.
Yeah.
On the other hand, we're not all running around madly, so we have a little bit more time to look at the data.
Don't we all? Peggy, thanks so much for speaking with me. I really appreciate it, and I hope you're doing well and safe.
I'm doing well. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
That was Peggy Hellweg of the Berkeley Seismology Laboratory speaking with producer Taylor Quimby. After the break, a listener question about tortoises leads us to a surprising place, and then another way science is being affected by the COVID-19 pandemic. That's coming up in just a minute on Outside In.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, kids of all ages, gather around your radio. It's time for Ask Sam.
Why do geese make V's? Does a bumblebee sneeze?
Can a person eat trees?
Can a polar bear freeze?
Is a kidney stone kind of like a pearl in a clam?
Well, I don't know. Ask Sam.
Wow, I do not know if I'm ready.
Get your snacks, kids. Everybody gather in.
All right. This question comes to us from Claudia, who does not say where she's from, but I believe somewhere in New Hampshire.
What is the difference between a turtle and a tortoise? Which do we have in New Hampshire? Could you give some examples of each, please?
Interesting question, Sam. I've always thought of it like the very simple answer is tortoises primarily stay on land.
Nailed it.
Turtles will
nailed it.
Will be in water. And a little side note for us, we're actually housing a tortoise at our house right now.
Okay, this is going to be perfect because you as a pet owner are ideally poised to answer many of these questions because as you alluded to, all tortoises are turtles, but not all turtles are tortoises, right? So
okay.
Tortoise is a subset of turtle. And according to Jennifer Moore of Grand Valley State University of Michigan, the main difference, as you said, is, of course, where they spend their time.
You know, if you're a tortoise that lives out in the desert and all of a sudden you come across a watering hole, ooh, lucky me, I might not see water for another 6 months or whatever. So yeah, they'll go sort of sit in water, but they're not like out swimming in lakes or something.
This is not to say that if a turtle suddenly decided it preferred being dry, it would suddenly become a tortoise, but just that the different habitats and different life histories of these animals have led them down different evolutionary paths. So like if you put a tortoise and a turtle side by side, the turtle would have sort of a more streamlined shell, better for swimming. And Thurusha Wijewardena, who is a PhD candidate at Laurentian University in Ontario, says you also tend to see it in their feet, too.
Turtles usually have webbed feet with long claws, which helps them swim. And tortoises usually have feet that are short and sturdy because they are meant for walking.
That sounds a lot like our tortoise. She's got very sturdy, kind of almost a claw-like hands.
Wait, so how long have you had this tortoise, Rick?
We had her last summer for a while. She is a...
I see. So this is the school pet, and you're just caring for this pet for a little while.
Well, maybe this may become a permanent situation.
Yeah, perhaps maybe for the rest of your life.
They last for many, many decades, yes.
Right, yeah. So estimated ages of the oldest tortoises in the world are like 150, 160 years old. There was one that may even have been 255 years old. And they're able to do that because they have incredibly slow metabolisms. They can live for weeks without water, maybe even years without food. There's a story in Brazil of a pet tortoise that the owners accidentally left in a shed and found it 30 years later still alive.
No.
They may have eaten something. They're not really sure how it survived, but 30 years.
By the way, it's called negligent pet sitting. But
that's how you get your turtle taken away from you by the authorities.
Yeah, that's right.
But the other part of this, the way that they live so long is they undergo periods of dormancy, which is really cool. And tortoises, which mostly come from dry parts of the world, they have evolved to do this during droughts.
If there's like a super duper dry period, they can just go dormant and just wait it out.
And here, and I will say, in fact, we do not have any tortoises in New Hampshire. We have box turtles, which do live a lot of their life on land. But evolutionarily, morphologically, they are turtles, not tortoises. But our turtles also undergo dormancy. They spend the entire winter underwater without ever taking a breath, which want to know how they do that?
Yeah.
So one of the things they do is they can breathe through their cloaca, which is kind of...
It's like their butt.
Basically, yeah.
All right, well, I'm going to let the audience make their own joke.
So we do not have those incredibly long-lived tortoises around here, but I would argue that our turtles can do things that are much cooler.
You know what? We're all trying new things in quarantine, so. When I woke up this morning, this was not on my mind. I had no idea what I was going to learn, but always Ask Sam. It's amazing. I always learn something new.
Thanks, Rick. That was an installment of Ask Sam, which airs on Morning Edition on alternate Fridays with Rick Ganley. If you have a question about the natural world or how we use it, serious or lighthearted, you can call us and leave us a voicemail at 1-844-GO-OTTER. Or, what's even more helpful, and to get higher audio quality, you can send us a recording using the Voice Memo app on iPhones or any other voice recorder on Android and email it to outsidein@nhpr.org. So throughout today's show, we have been checking in with some scientists to find out how their research is being impacted by coronavirus. We put out a call on Facebook and heard from people who can't get to their research locations because of travel restrictions, or alternatively, who are stuck at their research locations and can't get back home. A woman who works in Arctic geoscience explained that because there's a short seasonal window when many Arctic scientists can get access to their field sites, that the ongoing pandemic could cause a gap year in long-term Arctic data if people have to delay their plans even for a short time. Another issue in question is animal research. A number of articles have been written about the halting of research that involves handling bats, which may be susceptible to the coronavirus. We reached out to some local scientists that said because most outdoor bat research is conducted in the summer, at least here in New England anyway, those recommendations haven't had much of an impact yet. But one place where animal research is changing quickly is inside the labs. Kat Eschner is a contributing editor for Popular Science magazine, where she wrote about this issue. She also writes a newsletter called Quick Fox about animal-human relationships. Kat spoke with producer Taylor Quimby.
So, just generally speaking, I mean, animals are super important to research of all stripes, right?
Yeah, that's correct, I think.
And how would you say, I mean, if you were going to sort of categorize the different ways that you see animals in labs, I mean, what are just some of the categories?
Some of the categories, that's interesting. Some animals are used to do different kinds of psychological research and brain research, often non-human primates, but not solely, to kind of figure out how we humans think. In other experiments, animals are used as models for the human body. And sometimes they're gene edited, so they have specific diseases, or they're bred so they have specific diseases, or are likely to develop those diseases, so that people can test different medications, different treatments that they're hoping to use in humans later on.
Right. And you don't have any sense, just, you know, across the country, you know, how many lab animals there are at any given time?
That's a super hard question to answer. It's one that I would love to know the answer to. The answer is probably in the millions, from what I know. And that number seems to have taken an uptick since the advent of CRISPR, which is a gene edit, like a new generation of gene editing technology, because there's simply much more work you can do that hasn't been done previously. This is like a common thing. And when researchers gain the ability to do new stuff, they obviously want to try the new stuff. So it seems like there's an uptick, but we can't really know from the outside at this point.
Right, right. And especially, like, as you mentioned, there's so many different types of, you know, there's obviously lots of mice and rats, and there's non-human primates, which is sort of a weird euphemism, but one that's common in scientific research. So I can imagine, yeah, counting is difficult. But what have you sort of figured out is happening, you know, given this interruption of scientific research that's happening, you know, what has that meant for some of these animals?
Right. Well, first, I actually want to sidebar on that note on non-human primates.
Sure.
Because it is, like, I guess it is vaguely euphemistic, but, like, the field of sort of how we treat animals in general is very euphemistic. So things like words like humane, words like euthanize instead of kill, like what it's really hard to nail down a meaning for those words. And I feel like non-human primates is pretty clear.
Right.
They're primates. Right. So are we, but they are not human primate. Like I feel like it is like the least euphemistic euphemism in sort of the world of animal research.
Oh, yeah. No, it's an interesting point. It's an interesting point. The only reason I sort of say that is because I worked on a project and the specific non-human primate was a chimpanzee, but I think the researcher was avoiding saying a chimpanzee because I do think that for the public, sometimes it's easier to hear non-human primate than it is to specifically identify an animal.
That's a good point. Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, in this case, I was like, okay, so we're working with the chimpanzees. And she was like, well, we call them non-human primates. And I was like, but they are chimpanzees. You know, it was just this sort of weird back and forth. That led me to think that you're right, that it is both scientifically accurate, but also it is sometimes a way of avoiding, you know, the sort of anthropomorphization that people take to animals. Like, it's a pretty natural human thing that people do and is sometimes best avoided in a lab setting.
Yeah, no, I think that's right.
So what has the interruption of scientific research in all these different ways because of the coronavirus meant for some of these animals, as far as you've been able to figure out?
So in the popular science story, I wrote about the impacts of COVID-19 on lab animal research. I talked to one monkey researcher whose experiments had to be halted prematurely, but she told me, none of these researchers are named in my piece for reasons that I addressed, but obviously they're a bit concerned about their privacy. So her experiments had to be halted prematurely, but her monkey is okay. She actually just halted her experiments and she did something called capping her monkey, which is it had like a craniotomy, like a little hole in its head, so she could read brain electricity. And so she filled that little hole and the monkey itself is still living in the lab. So I should also emphasize it's not living in like a box or something. It's living in an environment that has enrichments and such. And it's being taken care of by technicians. A number of the lab technicians have been declared essential workers, so they can come in and like clean the cages, exercise some of the animal, that kind of basic care. So in her case, like the monkey's day-to-day life might be a bit different, but nothing bad has happened to her monkey. In other cases, and my understanding is like we're talking about a fairly significant number of cases with animals other than non-human primates across the US, experimental animals were culled, so they were killed in part to reduce the load on those technicians, but also because some of them were like mid-experiment, and if the results aren't going to be useful later, it just didn't make any sense to keep the animals alive and in cages.
Right. It might be unethical in a sort of weird way, right?
Yeah, well, so one of the researchers made this point, and I think this is a really important thing to remember when we're talking about animal research. She said, and this wasn't the monkey researcher, this was someone else I talked to. She said, you know, every case is different because animals are different, research is different, where the research was at was different. So there's really no one size fits all answer to this question. But, you know, numerous animals were killed. Or were culled in the language of the research to reduce the load on the technicians. And sometimes their bodies were frozen or preserved in other ways. And what the researchers are hoping is that they'll be able to sort of get the knowledge later by examining the bodies or examining the cell lines.
Right. And so, you know, if we're looking at some of these animals that we're talking about, you know, a lot of them also are, in my understanding, being bred for future research, in which case, that is another area where, you know, if that future research is currently stalled, delayed, you know, in a way that's very difficult to predict, again, doesn't make sense to keep breeding new animals.
Yeah, that's right. So the another animal, another researcher who I talk about in this story, she works with mice and she culled most of her mice. So she estimated 30 cages of 2 to 5 individuals. So that's a significant number of mice. And the only animals that are still alive are breeding stock animals who are not mature yet. So they're not ready to breed yet. And they're still alive and they're being cared for by technicians in the hopes that she'll be able to get back into the lab and you know, continue running her work. At this point, that's looking a little less likely. I think this has been a few weeks now that she's been out of the lab and not able to go back. But the other thing to note there is because one of the goals of animal research is to use as few animals as possible to reduce suffering, among other things, breeding stock animals need to be sorted. They need to be like phenotyped, so they need to be sort of genetically looked at and categorized. And they need to be bred very carefully once they reach maturity to reduce the number of total animals that are produced. So if she can't get in to do that work, she told me, then, you know, it may be the case that those animals will also not be useful in research down the line.
Right. I'm wondering, you know, just because this is the sort of subject that can be a little sensitive, at least to sort of open up to the public in a way. Was this a hard article to get people to talk to you about?
Well, I've been trying to report on animal testing for a long time, and it's hard in general to get people to open up about it, researchers, because there is this kind of this blowback that different people are sort of against animal testing in principle for different reasons. But then also people are like, as we talked about earlier, people are just kind of oogy about it. Right. I think we don't like to think about the ways we use animals, especially the painful or possibly deadly ways we use animals. I think it's worth remembering, however, that there's a lot of primary research for which there's currently no other options. Animal research is the option. Some primary research that used to be done with animals can be done with AI, and some of it can be done in other ways, but much of it can't. So when I'm reporting on this, one of the things I always think about too is that like asking individual researchers to account for the ethics of animal testing is much like asking individual meat eaters to account for the ethics of factory farming. Like it's a system, you know, and you can't ask an individual researcher to always account for that.
Right.
So, and the other thing I wanted to note is I have a lot of questions about research with animal models. I actually have a newsletter about animal-human relationships that dives into this pretty often. I don't think that research is always justifiable, but I also want to emphasize here that researchers aren't just randomly doing work. The animal research is governed by a number of ethical standards and rules, and researchers work under those rules and have to report regularly back to their university's animal research oversight committees about their work. So there is oversight.
Right. And you know, as we're talking about some of these things that are being delayed or put on hold, I would assume that, you know, the COVID-19 pandemic is actually fast-tracking other research projects that involve animal models for the very purpose of trying to end this pandemic.
Yeah, as I touched on in the piece, a number of different animal models are actually being used to research COVID-19. So animals are being used to actually look for a vaccine, look for different ways to understand this emerging disease. So animal models like mice, rhesus macaques, which are a kind of monkey, and ferrets are all being used to study COVID-19. My understanding is that ferrets have actually proved to be the best animal model. So we can't get away from animal research right now, even though the profile of it is changing.
Before I let you go, is there anything else that you think I should ask? I always like to ask at the end of an interview, just what is the question that I haven't asked that you wanted to answer?
Oh, this is the best question. And also, welcome to the Uji world of science reporting. it's all really uncomfortable. So I think that the most important point I tried to make in this piece, because like it was a bit challenging to write this piece as well, not just because, you know, animal researchers are reluctant to talk, but because I didn't want the public to sort of demonize these people, these researchers. I think the thing I want to highlight is that all the researchers who appear in my piece are very early career researchers, and their careers are really being interrupted by this pandemic as well, because of the way that academic hiring works and the sort of cycle on which academic life is. Their careers might be seriously interrupted as well. So we're not just talking about lab animals, we're also talking about the people who work with them, and as well the technicians who are currently still essential workers, still going in to keep the animals, you know, healthy, happy, and alive. I think it's worth noting that you can't really extricate those two costs. Although, you know, it's tempting to say, like it was tempting in the piece even to say, like, oh, well, these animals died, so the cost was higher to them. But that's not really an accurate accounting of all the ways that this pandemic has reshaped research.
Yeah. Well, Kat, thank you so much for speaking with me. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
That was Kat Eschner, contributing editor to Popular Science and the author of the Quick Fox newsletter, which you can find at quickfox.ca. That's it for Outside In this week. This broadcast was produced by me, Sam Evans-Brown, Taylor Quimby, and Justine Paradise, and also featured work produced with Logan Shannon, Hannah McCarthy, Nick Capodice, and Jimmy Gutierrez. Erica Janik is our executive producer. Maureen McMurray is director of the Department of Coming Out of Your Shell, which is, in fact, impossible for a turtle. Special thanks to Luke Poirier, Jonathan Taggart, and the Gulf of Maine Research Institute. Music for this episode came from Ari De Niro, Blue Dot Sessions, Ikimashu Aoi, and Poddington Bear. Outside In is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.